Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. With all the turmoil going on in the world, many wineries have realised they need to diversify their export markets. If that's you, have you thought about Finland? Like other Nordic countries, it has an alcohol monopoly, but it also has a thriving restaurant and wine bar scene where good wines are appreciated. I know this because I was in Helsinki late last year and I loved the restaurant and wine scene. While I was there, I caught up with Heidi Mäkinen, MW, who is portfolio manager and partner of Initie, an importing company. But that doesn't begin to describe her expertise. She's a veteran of sommelier competitions and a former best sommelier of Finland. She became president of the Finnish Sommeliers Association for 4 years and is now a member of the ASI Sommeliers Contests Committee. She's also a WSET educator. And she understands food and can explain why Riesling does so well in Finland. I hope by the end of the episode, you are booking your flight. Heidi, it's so great to see you.
Hi, Felicity. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. The last time we saw each other was in Helsinki in summertime, which was fantastic.
Exactly. It's a bit more snowy now.
What do you all do in the wintertime? Because wintertime is very dark from what I understand.
Yeah, we hibernate. No, it depends how you take it. I've recently started to enjoy the winters and the snow, and I'm forcing myself.
Recently, that suggests that for previously in your life you haven't enjoyed winters, which must be quite tough.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a conscious decision that you have to make, that if you are, you know, outdoorsy person like I am, you just have to be able to have the gear that you can be outdoorsy also in the wintertime, and this is what I have these days, and I'm really excited to have all the four seasons that we have in Finland.
Yes. One of the things I learned about a month ago was that 10% of people in Finland own a piece of forest. Do you own a piece of forest?
I don't own a piece of forest, but it is indeed a kind of an investment strategy for many Finns, yeah.
Oh, so it's not just somewhere that you go and picnic. Is it your own, like, paper mill tree, or why do people invest in forests?
Well, I guess it's the land value. Of course, you know, I think you can give other people the different, like, professional companies the availability to use the wood in the forest that you're doing or that you're having. I know I have a friend who's very environmental friendly, and he decided to buy two pieces of forest land because he wanted to protect the species living there. So it's for various reasons, but it is an investment. And yeah, you can gain from it.
All right. So I'll come back to this because I've got so many questions about Finland, but we should get into the professional subject of this, which is that you are an award-winning sommelier. You were head of, for a time, of the Finland Sommelier Association. You're now a distributor and a co-owner of a distributor called Venate. So let's start with, because I think most people listening won't know a thing about Finland and its wine market, can you talk about how you got into wine in the first place?
Absolutely. Well, so my personal journey actually started in the UK. So when I was 18, I decided to have a gap year between high school and university, and I ended up working in a small inn in Oxfordshire, and basically got excited about service and food, and then later on wine. So when I came back to Finland to start my university studies, I took an evening job in a restaurant, and it was a really fancy restaurant where we were selling a lot of, you know, really great wines that I didn't know much about, and the food products was amazing. So eventually I was just very curious, and I wanted to learn more and more about what I was serving my guests every night, and then that's when the wine bug got me.
And what did you study at university?
So I studied theatre and drama research. So when I was a teenager, wow, Theatre was pretty much my only passion. But I was not very, you know, talented as an actor or a director. So I thought if I did academic studies in theatre, maybe I could then find my way into the theatre world. But later on, I realised that the bug for wine and restaurant business was much bigger.
Is that why you ended up in England?
So when I moved to England at the age of 18, I mostly moved there because I wanted to learn the language. I really wanted to learn to
speak. Oh, right. So it wasn't because of the theatre?
No.
Oh, well, actually, so this all makes sense now because, I first met you because I came and did a very bad job of judging the Finnish sommelier competition on stage and, of course, alongside you, and you had to tell me all the things to do because I didn't know about them. But one of the things that strikes me is how theatrical it is.
Right, yeah, it is. Basically all the sommelier competitions, you kind of create a theatre scene of a restaurant evening where you have guests and you're doing the service and all the guests have different requirements and needs and you have to kind of go through the tasks to survive, basically.
Yeah, and it's like an English country house farce because everything goes wrong and the sommelier's job is to work out what's going wrong and to fix it.
Right.
So now you yourself have had a fantastic career in competitions. So you were working at a restaurant at night. How did you go from that to becoming the best sommelier of Finland?
So, when I entered the restaurant business, I had no background studies, no information. I basically learned by doing and, asking a lot of questions from my colleagues, which must have been daunting that time. And then I just, kind of developed my skills working from, one restaurant to another and really pushing myself to understand different aspects of the business. And I was very curious and interested in the product. So I wanted to learn everything about what's happening in the kitchen and what was happening with the wines that we were serving, because I never wanted to have that kind of situation where a guest would ask me a question and I would have to say, wait a minute, I'll go and check. I always wanted to have that answer straight away. So then I started to study wine. I took a sommelier course in Finland and then gradually, learned myself through the WSET, and then at some point I did try a sommelier competition, which I hated the experience, and I decided I would never ever compete again. But then a couple of years.
Why did you hate it? What was so awful? I mean, I can imagine what was so awful about it, but you tell me what was awful about it for you.
Yeah. Well, I guess the time that I joined the competition scene here in Finland, it was so too much in my liking. The theoretical questions and the tasks were just about the sponsors, which are hugely important to the industry. Don't get me wrong. And the competitions, but it was just more like, maybe it was my immaturity, but I felt like if I only need to know about the sponsor's wines or the sponsor's water or whatever it was that they were sponsoring the competition, then maybe that competition is not for me. And then I was a very opinionated young woman and I wanted to say, okay, I won't compete again. But then, a couple of years later, I changed employer and then I decided that, I should probably try it again. Because I also realized that if you compete, you get to meet a lot of people. You probably get to travel to places where the competitions are held. And I ended up actually going to a competition in Finland in the hope that if I would win it, I would be able to join the Young Sommeliers World Championships in Adelaide in Australia, which happened. And I got a trip to Australia. So, yeah, that kind of changed my mind in competitions.
And how did you find it?
Then I really loved it. I mean, I always love to challenge myself professionally or otherwise. And it was a great experience. I learned a lot. And also what I really enjoyed about competitions is the people you meet. I mean, I have now, probably in 40 different countries around the world, I have somebody who I can call if I go in and visit. So it's really the network that I've been able to gain through competitions and international work. And those friendships. And of course, you learn a lot on the go as well.
Yeah, I edited the first draft of Gero Basset's memoirs, and for anyone who doesn't know, Gero Basset was an outstanding sommelier who mentored lots of people, but he became sommelier of the world after many attempts. And what was difficult about editing the book was he wanted to mention everybody because he'd made so many friends that were sommeliers. I kept saying to him, please don't put this list of people in Gero. It was like the Bible, it was like Joshua begat this person, begat that person. And I was like, don't do this, Gero. But he was just so full of generosity and friendship for the tight-knit circuit that it clearly is. So
our industry is all about the people, right? We love the product, but it's the people we want to work with.
That's right. So how did you become, what happened with Best Sommelier of Finland? Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, so I became Best Sommelier of Finland in 2015, if I recall right. And then that gave me an access to enter the kind of the adult version of the World Championships. So that was in the spring 2016, I think. I went to Argentina, to Mendoza, to compete and represented Finland there. And I managed to become number 8 together with the Japanese candidate. And then it kind of all just sparked. I mean, I afterwards I decided that I wanted to move to London. I got offered a job because of my kind of reputation from the competitions. And although after that, my competition career was relatively short because I wanted to concentrate on the Master of Wine studies. But it really gained me a lot of kind of access in the sommelier world, but also like just a lot of friends. And I got to know so many people from that experience. And I really loved it.
Were you the first MW for Finland?
No, I was number 4 actually. So we're
number 4.
Oh,
okay, yeah. Okay. So sorry, Finland. But, what made you decide to do that?
So I mean, curiosity has been really the driver for me for anything that I do in life. And because I had that sommelier competition background, I knew what kind of studying that is. And I always wanted to understand more the big picture. Like I really wanted to understand and not just memorize. And I kind of never considered myself to start doing like Court of Master Sommeliers, which is much more linked to, of course, the restaurant world, but also like similar study to the competitions. So I rather wanted to learn to understand viticulture and winemaking from the perspective that WSET was teaching. And then I just realized that after I had done my diploma, I realized there were still so many questions I could not answer in terms of wine that I just needed to push myself forward.
Now, I know that Finland is becoming a wine country as climate change bites, but it's not been known as a wine country. So what was it like to be from a Nordic country where wine is pretty expensive, training for the MW?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, in the first place, before I even started the MW process, all my kind of wine knowledge has been very theory driven because we didn't have the access to all these wines that I was reading about. It was only when I moved to UK and London when I managed to I went to work in a private members club where I was able to access all the wines in the world and go to tastings before work where I could taste all the rest of the wines. And that was really kind of a life-changing moment for me because everything theoretical came suddenly, physically there in my glass. And being a Finn, it's useful because we're not a wine producing country, so we're relatively open to the whole of wine world, and we don't have that kind of terroir respect in a way that if you go to Burgundy in France, most restaurant wine lists are full of Burgundian wines. So we had an open book for the world of wine. It's just that because, like you said, it's a expensive country. Our taxation is very high in terms of wine. And it's very price-driven market as well. So a lot of the restaurants or the Alka stores, the Monopoly stores here, don't stock those very expensive bottles because there's not much demand for them.
So how do you get hold of them? So you've really got to go somewhere else to study.
Yeah. So, there's a few restaurants that do have access. And actually, it was when I moved back home from London in 2018, I realized that the market had opened up and developed a lot from since I left. So there was a lot of wines that do come into this market, but mostly if we're talking about highly respected Burgundy estates, for example, we might get 120 150 bottles that are only distributed to certain restaurants, so they never go into the alcohol monopoly stores. So people who really want to have these wines, they need to go to those certain restaurants that have them on their list, or they need to travel, whether it's to the regions where those wines are produced, or visit other countries, or maybe buy their wines in the foreign market.
So you're talking about a club in London. I assume you're talking about 67 Pall Mall.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And what was it like working there?
Well, like I said, it was an amazing time in my life because I moved to London for two reasons. I wanted to have international work experience from a city like London. That was my favorite city at that time. And also I wanted to be able to be in the middle of Wine Hub when I was doing my Master of Wine studies. So those two things, it was like the perfect place for me because every single day I would taste, tens of wines, assessing especially all the classics, different vintages on a constant basis. I was able to taste all the wines that I had only dreamt of or read about in my earlier studies. I could actually taste all those, you know, unicorns there. It was also very interesting for a SOM that time, because we organized a lot of masterclasses to our members. So it got me a lot of training in doing speeches in front of people and creating concepts and so forth. And also just being in London, I mean, it is still a wine hub. So everything was there. There were so many tastings that I could have gone into every single day if I didn't need to split my time only between studying and work.
Mm. And it's, you know, people I think are pretty generous if you show an interest. You know, yeah, it still remains, I think, the most important wine place in the world, just because it's the home of all of the institutions, the WSET and the Institute of Master of Wine and LiveX and so on. So they really dominate the way that the world learns about wine.
Absolutely. And of course, the city has a lot of cash. I mean, if you look at all the bankers and lawyers that the city itself hosts, there's a lot of demand for those kind of wines as well.
So what took you back to Finland?
I was quite tired after very intense 2 years of studies and work. And also I got to the point that I was thinking, you know, if I looked for a new place to work, I felt like going to another restaurant would not perhaps teach me enough new things anymore. And I really wanted to learn another aspect of the wine world. And then there was a position with an importer, Vinitier, which I'm still working at after 6 years, that kind of got my interest. And I thought maybe that would be a nice next step in my career. And just the thought of, you know, coming to Finland back home and starting something new sounded really exciting. And then I decided to move back, yeah.
All right, let's talk about Finland's wine market. So obviously things have changed a lot. How has it developed in your lifetime?
So I was born in late 80s and, you know, wine was free that time. I was just going through...
Okay, so let's stop. You do not mean they were handing out wine on the street.
I'm saying free because we have a kind of an interesting history when it comes to beverages. So first of all, we had prohibition from 1919 to 1932. And ever since that as well, things were not very easy if you wanted to buy alcohol. So, you know, around the Second World War, we had something called a Winter War. And during that time, there was a system that you could buy booze from monopoly stores, but it was limited. So you really needed to show how much you bought from before, how much you are able to buy now. And if you were buying too much, maybe your license of buying was taking off for a while. And there was a lot of like restrictions on how much you could buy. And then, you know, during those 50s, 60s, it was not easy to buy wine. So you had to walk to a shop and actually ask for a product instead of just going to grab the wine from the shelf. And I think it was only like in 1960s or maybe even early 70s when these kind of nowadays usual wine shops came along where you can go and take the product yourself from the shelf instead of like being intimidated and trying to pronounce something to the shop clerk behind the desk.
Can I just go back? You know, Finland was one of the few places in the Western world to have prohibition. The United States was one, New Zealand was another. What drove prohibition and why did they get rid of it?
Well, I mean, I guess it was just kind of the atmosphere of the time, you know, from the first around the First World War, it was illegal to distribute alcoholic beverages. I think it was, you know, got to do with health and finances and things like this. And then in 1919, indeed, they decided that, you know, you can't make, you can't produce, you can't transport, you can't sell, you can't store alcohol. It was only allowed for like, you know, medicinal reasons or scientific meanings. And this went on until 1932 when it was lifted, the prohibition.
Was it mostly spirits drinking or was it spirits and beer at that point?
So that point was a lot about spirits and beer. And I think it was in 1950s when people or the authorities, they started to campaign for lighter beverages or wines or fortified wines over spirits. And then we hosted Olympic Games in 1952, and that's when a kind of famous long drink was produced. So it was also like that time when some of those developments in the market started to happen. But for a long time, we were very much focused on spirits and beer, and we essentially still today, we are a beer drinking nation. 50% of our consumption is in beer, whereas wine and spirits are respectively about 20% each.
Mm. Okay, so when did the monopoly come along?
So it was, I believe it was monopoly, you know, from very early on. I think it was 1932, exactly after Prohibition, when the state government got the license on its own to you know, import and make and sell alcoholic beverages. So yeah, it's been almost 100 years since the monopoly existed.
Oh my God, it has almost been 100 years. Goodness gracious. Okay, so go back to the question of how the wine market has developed just in your lifetime.
Right. I think it's much more diverse these days. Obviously, you know, consumption in restaurants and in general, like restaurant industry has started to boom over the last couple of decades. It's no longer just a Mother's Day or 50th birthday when you go out and have a meal, but you actually might go there on a regular Tuesday and drink a glass or two. And so that's really been something that I've seen, especially, you know, in the bigger cities where privately owned restaurants exist these days. It's brought a lot of diversity to wine, and people are much more curious about wine. Unknown names are brought to the market compared to the, you know, couple of decades ago when there was basically, you know, some French big names and that's it. So it's become a really interesting market. I think there's also quite a bit of possibilities still that you can create here in terms of like comparison to some saturated markets. You can still create something new and create better wine culture in our country. And it is diverse also in terms of not just certain styles, but also like price points. And people are very curious and open-minded. Like you go to a restaurant and you often ask the sommelier for a recommendation because we're very kind of oriented with having food and wine together.
All right. And tell me about Finland's food scene.
So we've always been influenced from both sides of our neighbours. Obviously, you know, Finland has not been historically a very rich country. So a lot of the culinary scene has come from that background of being, you know, creating or growing your own vegetables or herding your own cows or pigs and then preserving as much as you can for the long and dark winter, like you said. So still today, we have a lot of that kind of preserving history, and that's something that the restaurants over the last 10 years have really actually taken on board again. So we see a lot of pickling, a lot of curing of fishes and vegetables. I think in general, like we have like 180,000 lakes in our country, so there's a lot of freshwater fish. Yeah, there's a lot of freshwater fish in this country. Of course, you know, in the coastal, you know, Helsinki or the coastal part of Finland, you also get a lot of seafood and sea fish. And also, of course, you know, if you think about the West, there's a lot of influence from Sweden. So that kind of crayfish parties and all that you link with Sweden is also quite common there. But I think there's a lot of that kind of agricultural feeling to Finland, but in a sense that we need to make sure that we also have something to eat during the winter.
Yeah, I imagine. Okay, so what else do I want to ask you? Let's go back to the sommelier world. So if wine culture is relatively, I won't say new, but if it's evolved over the last couple of decades, where does the sommelier sit in the restaurant hierarchy? Is it something that is a usual thing, or is it still very unusual, except in fine dining, to see a sommelier?
No, nowadays you see sommeliers much more. I would say over the last, you know, 2-3 decades in general, it's been a growing position in a restaurant. For certainly, yes, in more like bigger cities, and often the position of a sommelier is combined with that of restaurant manager, or you know, taking in charge of all the beverages, or you know, all the orders. So it's not, it's only a couple of restaurants where the sommelier would only be serving wine. So often the sommeliers here as well, you know, do other tasks like carrying plates to the tables and so forth. But it's been a growing profession, and people are, you know, people nowadays know what a sommelier means, and it's really exciting to see the enthusiasm and also the appreciation from guests towards the knowledge that the sommelier might have. So yeah, it's I think that's also kind of becoming more normalized, and thus creating again, you know, the wine culture forward in our country.
As the head of the Finland Sommelier Association, what sort of issues do you deal with, or how does it all work?
Well, I mean, when I was the president for the last couple of years, I've now given the responsibility for somebody else. It was more about, you know, trying to find ways where we can, first of all, put Finland on the world map of wine when it comes to like the International Sommelier Association, so making sure that people actually know that we are important. And that's why we organized the General Assembly for the International Sommelier Association in Finland. We've organized a couple of wine symposiums where we take, you know, very important wine people to come and talk to a crowd of people about wine in Finland. So we're trying to make Finland kind of a hub in the world, but also within Finland, we've been trying to create our association to be the kind of backbone of the sommelier profession. So we're trying to support sommeliers in their paths, whether they are, you know, competing to get to educate themselves, or whether we're trying to, in general, just raise the awareness of sommelier in Finland. And this is how we do, you know, of course, the competitions is something, they are something that people, it's easily the most visible thing, because it's kind of a, like you said, like a show itself, coming to watch those competitions, and of course, you know, getting those merits and credits and representing our country elsewhere. But it's also, I think for me also, I would love to see the Sommelier Association kind of like, you know, like a supporting the whole trade in a way that's, you know, it's not, perhaps not going into legal issues, but somehow like being there as a support for all people who want to be in the profession and develop themselves.
Yeah. So given that you do have these spectacular summers, I mean, it's really sunny and bright, and then you have profound winters, how does the restaurant trade fluctuate over the course of the year? And how does drinking fluctuate over the course of the year?
So I'd say we are very seasonal drinkers in this country. So, you know, when the first sun comes out in the spring, you can already see these people, you know, drinking rosé wine in their shorts on the terrace. So we're very excited about seeing the sun and feeling a bit of warmth on our skin. So in general, you know, we drink a lot of comfy, fruit-driven, spicy, comforting red wines during the winter. And then in the summer, we love fresh, fruity wines with, you know, juicy acidity and a bit of rosé as well. And we are quite a big sparkling wine drinkers as well. Of course, you know, some restaurants, there are certain restaurants that don't really work during the summertime. If it's great weather and you don't have a terrace, then it might be difficult to get people to come and enjoy fine dining restaurant. But if you have a terrace by the sea or by a lake, you'll be packed. So we're really trying to enjoy the days when the nature gives us great weather and be outdoors as much as possible.
So I've heard a rumour about Finland that whenever the Finnish military go anywhere, the first thing they do is they strike a sauna. that's the first thing. Like with the Germans, it's open a beer. With the Finns, it's make sure the sauna is in order. All right, so Finland is a monopoly market, so we should talk about that. The monopoly is called Alko. For anybody who's listening who is thinking about exporting to Finland, can you explain how it all works?
Absolutely. So, indeed. So for private consumers, there is the monopoly, but the restaurants can buy straight from importers who have a distribution license. But if you are a producer and you want, I mean, of course, it depends which top, which market you want to, well, which channel you want to target. So if I take a reference of our company, Vinitia, we are a multi-channel distributor. So we have our own warehouse where we import all the wines that we buy, and then we basically sell them to different channels, Alco being one of them. And within Alco, there are several ways to get your wines to the selection. So, of course, there are those purchasing plans, tenders that you can win, and then you get a certain allocation of or secured purchases of that particular wine and allocated stores and distribution. But there's also other ways to get to the to those 350 Alco stores as a maximum capacity, if you wish. So every
such as
so every. Every distributor can add products to the sale to order selection of Alco, which basically means that they are listed to Alco's web store. And then, you know, if you are somebody who loves to shop online, you can easily find those wines through the web store and buy them to any pickup point, any store that you'd
So if there's enough buzz generated online, does that mean that Alco is more likely to put you in their selection?
Yeah, so basically they've given out set limits. So if your sale to order product sells for a minimum amount within the restricted period of time, Alco would kind of lift that status from the sale to order selection to the general selection. So that's how, for example, our company has been doing some of our biggest success stories is that we've listed to the sale to order selection. We've invested a huge amount of marketing and promotion for that wine. So the people would go and buy that wine, whether online or whether from a couple of Alco stores who have decided to take the product on the shelves, even if it's not kind of, they're not implied to do it because it's not a general selection wine. And then we've kind of created the demand for to be so big that it's become part of the regular selection of most stores.
Actually, that was going to be my next question. So let's say you get a distributor and you get listed online. What do you do to become known in Finland? What marketing and strategies do you use?
Well, I mean, in our case, our kind of core has always been and still is the HoReCa market. So I'm a strong believer. I know some people disagree with me, but I think that brands are definitely built in the restaurants. And some of those, you know, people go into restaurants and they drink certain wines and they might look for those wines when they're buying wine for their home as well. So that's one job, of course. But then, of course, if you add something to the sale to order selection, so we can advertise in our country. So that is legal. So you can do whether online, social media or print advertisement. You can organize events where people can taste those wines, or especially, you know, like Alco staff can come and do a professional tasting and get familiarized with those products. We can send out some information also to Alco and to store managers, and we can send PR samples to journalists hoping for them to create some content and give nice reviews about those wines. So there are several actions that you can do.
So how big is the wine media?
The wine media is not so big at the moment, but I think it's actually for the last 2 years, it's been growing a bit. I think there's a couple of...
Wow, that's good news. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think there's a couple of individuals who are being much more active and also embracing social media to get, you know, my generation and younger people to get excited about wine, because we all know what's happening to print media. So there's a lot of that kind of cross use of media, I would say. So, you know, they are still writing articles about wine and themes and topics on a couple of our wine magazines, which tend to be wine and food magazines, but then also kind of doing a lot of cross-referencing in their social media channels as well. So we don't really have, you know, several publications where wine is being, you know, on our weekly column or anything like this. There's a couple of those, but then we do have a couple of food and wine magazines, and one just about wine, which has with the recent editor has actually become very much relevant also for the professionals. So it's no longer so much a lifestyle magazine that it used to be, but we don't have, you know, things like Decanter or the drinks business as such, but there's some good content being written about wine in Finland too.
And what's the demographic who drinks wine? Are you seeing the same thing that a lot of other countries are seeing, which is that young people are abandoning it, or are you seeing that you can still engage younger people with wine?
Well, I think, you know, it depends on... I've been listening to a lot about your podcast, and I'm wary about that, you know, thinking about demographics. But, you know, I see... I know what's happening in like wine producing countries where young people are really kind of not choosing wine because that was their parents' drink and they're going for beer. I think here it's a bit mixed. Also, of course, like everywhere else, you know, there's a big beer culture, like I mentioned. People love cocktails. There is a market for ready to drinks. But I do still think that wine is embraced by all different age profiles. Maybe it's part, you know, somehow linked to the education level. So if you are from a bigger city, if you've been to, for example, I don't know, university, or if you studied a bit more, maybe it's a bit more seen in those amongst those people, whereas beer is like still kind of considered that everybody can drink it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that wine is kind of embraced by a mixed consumer base.
Explain Finnish long drinks to me.
So obviously there's a lot of variation, but when the Olympic Games were held in our country in 1952, the long drink that was created was basically grapefruit and gin. And that's the classic.
Because I had that on Finnair when I was going to, and I thought, is this a long drink? So that's a classic one. Okay, tell me more.
That's the classic one. But of course, nowadays, you know, there's these companies who create these long drinks, and they come up, you know, annually with a new taste. So I think it was last year or 2 years ago when they came up with a new flavor, which was pineapple. And pineapple long drink became like, it was booming that summer. I think it was 2023 summer. And it's just, you know, every year now, ever since, people have been asking like, okay, what's the new, you know, breakthrough drink flavor?
So and pineapple so and what? What else was in it?
I guess still based on gin. So pineapple and gin, but I haven't really looked at the ingredients.
What an interesting combination. Really, well, that leads me to, I understand from things I've read that the Finnish like Riesling and they like acidity a lot. So that sounds like that supports that thesis. Why is that? What is it about the food that speaks of acidity?
Well, I think it's part of it's the pickle. So part of it's the vinegars and things like that we're adding to a lot of our preserved vegetables or things like that. We also have a lot of like cured and salted fish, you know, whether it's herring or cured salmon or anything like that. So I think it's just the food culture really welcomes kind of fruity, acid-driven fresh wines in comparison to some other markets. And, you know, part of the success of Riesling could also be a silly reason, like it's a grape variety that's easy to pronounce. Mm-hmm. Not everybody even knows that it's a grape variety. They just know that they've had a Riesling once and they liked it, so they might go and re-ask it, you know, I'll have a Riesling, to the extent that some sommeliers are kind of getting a bit bored. but it is still, you know, it's been like a synonym for white wine, and I do see a bit more diversity nowadays. But I mean, I'm always about the opinion that people should drink what they like, and if they like Riesling, go for it.
That's so interesting, because I got a friend of mine, Richard Grosher, who runs a winery in the Mosel, and he always says the problem with Riesling is that because it expresses its terroir so well, you don't always know what you're going to get. So a Riesling from Rheinhessen is completely different from a Riesling from the Mosel, and that's why it never works as a sort of generic white wine. Well, but you're saying it does work as a generic white wine.
Well, I mean, I've had this conversation with Richard, and we import his wines to Finland, and you know, it is exciting because it gives you so much. And sometimes, you know, when people are frustrated that people always just ask for Riesling, you know, I feel like, yeah, but actually that will give you an opportunity to explain to your guests how diverse even that one single grape variety can be. And that you can then take those guests on a journey, like with different Rieslings, for example. So, yeah, I understand in a point that, you know, go and pick up an Alice's bottle and you might not know the sugar level until recently when there's that kind of measure at the back indicating the sweetness. But it's also, you know, I think it's a point of discussion when you face that situation. And you could actually, you know, create an experience for somebody.
How interesting. Okay, so I should ask you, what doesn't work in Finland? What's a... No.
So what I kind of miss from London in particular is the smaller, newer producers that we don't really see here. And there's various reasons for that. I mean, I would say a lot of the sommeliers here haven't been exposed themselves to taste those wines, so they don't know to ask about them. A lot of smaller new world producers don't have a central European warehouse where importers could get small amounts. Those wines tend to be also quite expensive, and a lot of people think that it's more environmentally friendly to have somehow get the wines from closer to Finland to here than shipping it, which is, you know, we can have a long conversation about trucks versus shipping in terms of ecological impact. But there's a lot of those kind of wines that we don't really see in this market, whether it's something that wouldn't work or whether it's something that it's just kind of a bit too esoteric for a lot of people who haven't tasted those wines is a different thing.
Can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
Well, yeah, I mean, so I've had a chance to go to Australia, for example, for a couple of times, and there's a lot of, like, amazing, for example, Pinot Noir Chardonnay producers that I love, coming from Adelaide Hills, for example, and I would love to see those wines here, but when they would enter the Finnish market, they would be, you know, selling to restaurant at 30 euros, so for the final consumer, it could be close to 100 euros. So yeah, that can be quite difficult after all the taxes and logistics. And then
can you explain that point you just made about not being in a central European warehouse? So is that where you get your wines from, where they're shipped? So do they already have to be in Europe before you can get into the Finnish market?
No, they don't need to be, but if you're buying small amounts, it can be quite tricky to just make a purchase that's logistically economical for you to order from a New World location, just one pallet that's been taken to a shipping container. So it's easier for smaller producers, or even larger producers who are based, for example, in Australia or US, if they have a central European hub, often in Belgium or in Germany, where then a lot of the European distributors and importers can make a couple of pallet orders at once instead of needing to stock like 20 pallets in their warehouses. So if you had that kind of access, it would be allowing smaller producers to be distributed also wider in Europe through that.
Oh, I see. Okay. Low and no alcohol.
Well, January, isn't it? So we do see a lot more interest towards these products, especially in the gastronomy, because people, I mean, fair enough, you know, restaurants can make much more profit on serving an alternative to water if somebody's not drinking alcoholic beverage for a reason. So I do think that it's great to have them. And I always say that the wine world is much lagging behind the beer world, where, you know, non-alcoholic beer can actually be quite tasty. With wines, it is difficult because it's quite processed. And you're taking an integral part of the wine, a structural part of the wine away. So what do you replace it with? Often with sugar. So some of those drinks might be quite difficult to then enjoy in a gastronomic environment. But I do think that it's a relevant category, and it's something that we should invest much more research into and develop those products. But it's really hot tough. And I see that we've done better with, of course, sparkling and white than we have with red.
Yeah, I mean, of course, with non-alcoholic beer, you can actually ferment beer to dryness and it still has all of the characteristics of beer without the alcohol. So I wonder if it's ever going to be possible with wine without adding flavours or adding other things to it. You know, people tell me, you know, people always send me samples and they tell me that they've cracked whatever problem, you know, too much sugar or too much acidity. And then what they've done is they've brought out the floral notes or something like that, which can be quite difficult. Okay, so trends, what are you seeing?
Well, at the moment, the Finnish market is in a bit of a changing period. So, you know, last summer we allowed some of the restrictions from the monopoly are being lifted at the moment. So since last summer, we've been allowing anything up to 8% to be sold in supermarkets, which has kind of created a new subcategory for wine, you know, anything up to 8%, with some wines being obviously naturally 8%, like, you know, Cabernet and Spätlese from your, you know, Mosel, for example. But then a lot of 8% wines have been crafted to our market, yeah, whether it's by dilution or by partly de-alcoholizing those wines. It'll be interesting to see if this is just a period when this new law is in place and whether something else is going to happen. It remains to be seen over the next months. But apart from that, I mean, I do see the overall Well, I saw the overall, you know, lesser but better premiumization trend in Finland also, at least until last year. But with the economic situation, I think a lot of people have needed to cut down the use of wine, and then also maybe they've been looking for a bit more value options in general. What restaurant friends tell me is that people still come and eat, but they do drink much less. So whether they used to have a bottle, now they would probably have at least one or two glasses. But I haven't really asked whether they're spending more or whether it's they are looking for those value options. But in general, I do see a lot of diversification for that Riesling craze that we've had. So, for example, you know, Spanish Albarinos have been getting much more established over the last years. We're quite excited about Austrian wine, especially in gastronomy as well. In terms of red, we've been big drinkers of wines from Veneto, like Ripasso, unless we can afford, you know, Amarone. But nowadays, I do see people looking for lighter styles of red wines as well. Piedmont has been growing. But we are still a lot about, you know, kind of relatively simplistic way of wine. So it's easy for us to buy something that has the great variety on the label. So wines from Chile have still been quite popular in our country, and also because of the relatively good value that often those wines have. So, you know, sometimes it's when you think about trends, you kind of starting to try to think why they have become trends. And I do think that especially last year, the economic situation has imposed some of those things for people's consumption.
You're also a wine educator. Who's interested in wine education in Finland, apart from professionals?
Well, I think actually wine education in general seems to be growing here. We don't have so many. Yeah, exactly. So we don't have so many operators who are offering it. So I'm teaching for one, and we do WSET levels 2, 3, and 4. And it's been exciting to see, like, on the level 2, most of the attendees are those who don't actually work in wine but have a thorough interest, and they just want to learn more. They just basically want to enjoy more, and they come on the course to learn a bit more, because I think oftentimes when you learn a bit more about something, you actually start enjoying it even further. On level 3, it tends to be more 50-50. And then on level 4, which is the diploma, you see, you know, a couple of people who don't work in wine, but a couple of them would like to maybe in the future work in wine or change their career. And the rest are professionals, whether Alcostore people, sommeliers, or importers. But it's really about that interest that people have.
What gets people interested in wine? Is it because they go traveling somewhere and bring back an interest in it? Is it linked to the people who are interested in food? Or what's the common denominator that sends somebody off to a wine course?
I think there's a lot of reasons. I've heard people say that actually in their work, they end up in situations where they might need to, you know, choose the wine or talk about it internationally. So that's been one of the reasons. For sure, what you mentioned, that people travel and they've had a great experience, and they are just really excited about it. Or they just, I mean, that happened to me as well. You know, I was working in a restaurant. I was working with a product I didn't know. So maybe it's also the guests who go to restaurants and they want to learn more about why they like this and why they don't like that. So it's just, you know, wine is so fascinating, and it combines so many exciting things in our world that people can come to it from various different angles. And that's the beauty of it.
Now, changing the subject completely, Finland, of course, is geographically in a very interesting area. You have a very, very big neighbour. Has the world in Finland changed since the Ukraine war broke out, or is everything, you just ignore what's going on?
No, a lot of things have changed, and I think the biggest change was that we became part of NATO. and I think that was kind of a turning point for a lot of people. So it was a bit, you know, I think a lot of people felt a bit insecure until we got that membership of NATO. And then ever since, people have been a bit more, you know, calm. Of course, nowadays, with a lot of things happening with the gas pipes on the Baltic Sea and well,
stopping Russian ships from wrecking.
Yeah, GPS harassment cables. Also. Yeah, GPS harassment also for some of the planes that are trying to
really?
Land.
I didn't know about that. What happens?
Well, I guess there's been a couple of occasions when, especially some smaller airports close to the border in the east, planes have not been able to land because they have not been able to get the signal. So there's a lot of like. Small but very, very,
sabotage.
You know, sabotaging occurrences. So I think we're watching the situation quite carefully. Of course, not living in fear, but it is something that, you know, the whole Europe should be paying attention to. And we are trying to support Ukraine as much as possible, of course, because we have that history.
Yeah, living in Germany, it's sometimes said that Russia has declared war. It's just nobody's noticed because there's lots of these sort of little acts of sabotage going on. Interesting. Okay, so what's next for you? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I am, apart from my normal work and you know, living the wine world, I do have a lot of different projects, which I'm quite excited about. So even if I don't work as a sommelier anymore and I don't work on the floor, I work very closely with SOM. So I'm still part of the International Sommelier Association and organizing a couple of exciting continental sommelier competitions this year, one in Sonoma in February.
Oh, wow.
For Americas, and then one for Asia and Pacific in Malaysia later this year.
Oh, wow.
But I also have a couple of projects, whether consultancy or just kind of speaking gigs around the world. And it's always fun because, I mean, wine world, you can do so many different things, and all those different gigs kind of help you to learn a new aspect about wine and keep you, you know, on your tip of your toes. You have to be paying attention to what's happening. And that's really something that I've always, that's why I'm in this industry, because I'm so curious and I still want to learn more.
And on that note, thank you so much for your time, Heidi.
This was great. Thank you, Felicity.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.